we as humans crave positive social connections. Mm-hmm. We love it when we're together. But the phone has made it so much easier not to be together than to actually be together. Could there ever be a day in our lifetime where suddenly the gambling addiction rate isn't 1 or 2%, but it's 30%, 15%? Now that would be a really, really difficult day.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the One Day at a Time podcast. Today's guest is Tim Fong. We're going to be talking all about gambling addiction, rates of gambling addiction, and how things have changed over the years that he's been working in the field. Tim, if you were to try to describe what you do in just a couple of words, what would you kind of say?
So thanks for having me on, Rob.
Of course.
Again, my name is Dr. Timothy Fong. I'm a professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine. Mm-hmm. For 20 years now, I, along with Dr. Richard Rosenthal, have been co-director of the UCLA Gambling Studies Program. I'm a physician first. Mm-hmm. I'm an addiction psychiatrist, specialized physician. And so really what I do every day is really four things: research, clinical care, teaching, and community engagement, all around the areas of addiction and mental health, but particularly around gambling, since that's what I've been doing the last 20 years.
So you've been doing gambling for 20 years. I feel like it's become kind of like a more popular topic maybe within the last 5 years or so. So we're going to want to get into how things have changed from when you started until today, but what motivated you to get started in a field that was likely much less popular back then?
So I'm Generation X. Mm. I grew up in the 70s and 80s in the western suburbs of Chicago, where there were no casinos, there was no internet, we had a lottery, and we had unregulated sports betting. In the mid-90s, I went to college, and the riverboat casinos started to come into play, and internet in the late 90s started to form. I've always had a fascination with gambling behavior, like why do people do it? How do you make money? Yeah. How do people fall into stories of addiction? And during medical school, I got interested in addiction. And this is the mid-90s, methamphetamine, cocaine use disorder. Yeah. And 1995 was the first time people were calling addiction is a brain disease. Now, you were born before, you know, after that.
After that.
But your generation only knows addiction as a brain disease. My generation knew addiction as an issue of morality, a lack of willpower, greed. And it was fascinating to me in medical school to say, well, wait a minute. There are these people that are addicted to, quote, behaviors, gambling, shopping, video games, and they're not ingesting a drug. So what's happening to their body, brain, and mind? And so all that led me to say I wanted to study addiction, 1998 to 2002. But it really wasn't until 2003 that I began to say, how do I make a career in addiction and what do I want to study? And I've always been interested in gambling. And right then, 2003, is when we started to see what? The rise of internet gambling, the rise of tribal gaming in America, the rise of sports betting being, quote, normalized, the rise of Las Vegas and destination gambling resorts as a family destination. So gambling was becoming much, much more mainstream. And throughout my career in medical school and residency, we did not see a lot of men and women with gambling addiction at all. So all those curious things kind of coalesced into this idea of how do we study gambling? Where does it fit? How does it make sense in brain and behavior? And is this an important public health problem or not? So all of that was really around 2002, 2003, how I got interested in. And I think my very, very first conference was a National Council of Problem Gambling annual conference in Dallas, Texas. And that was my, I didn't know anything, but that's really where I got introduced to the field about what people know, what people don't know, what the burning questions are and things like that. And been doing work ever since.
Wow. It really interests me that you say that sports betting was becoming normalized in 2003. Because, I mean, myself being that, you know, I was four in 2003, but also the fact that, like, I've lived through the new normalization of sports betting, the online sports betting. It's interesting to hear you say that. And it kind of begs the question, were as many people getting into sports betting back then? What did the average sports bettor look like in 2003?
So, again, you know, go back to, this is before your world. Sports pages every day printing betting lines in the back. Real live bookies, placing bets over the phone, going to brick and mortar casinos to bet, then, you know, Las Vegas mainly like that. So it was always sports betting occurring, but it was always, again, unregulated. It was attached more to kind of an organized criminal element per se.
Yeah.
But like for me in college, I went to college 94 to 98, there were a number of bookies that you could access to bet on sports. Fantasy baseball also started in late 80s. As kind of a, and did you know it used to be called rotisserie baseball?
No.
So, and, you know, right, and so Bill James and all these, you know, fans. So for me, I started playing fantasy baseball early 90s, and that was all tied into sports betting and, you know, numbers and power of stats. And so all that has always been there. What we did not have is an understanding of how significant sports betting was in the national landscape, because it was not talked about. So you go back to football broadcast in the early 80s, you know, they would talk about who's going to win, who's going to lose. And there'd be a couple discussions about gambling, but it was never brought to the forefront. So there was always this uncomfortable, we know it's happening, but we just don't celebrate, we don't advertise it, we don't talk about it. A friend of mine gave me this, I wish I'd brought it, a board game that essentially is betting on a football game.
Okay.
And it's a board game, and it essentially is the game you play while watching football, and it was all about making bets. And so that was a game you could buy like in a Toys R Us sort of thing. So I think we forget that sports betting and betting on sports have been around since the dawn of our country, if not even before that. The popularity has always been there in the sense that there's been a group doing it. But just the idea that we have a whole generation and normalizing with advertising now, that's what's so radically different. Because again, when I was, when you were my age, mid to late 90s, to bet on sports required effort, a contact. It was definitely recognized as a unethical activity. It was not supported, and but it definitely still occurred. And the power of the internet really started to bring to bear all that ability to bet on sports. Again, early days, it would just be straight emails and things like that. But again, 70s and 80s, people would do it the way they would always do other things, with these little notebooks and the things that you see classically in movies. That's how people bet on sports.
You mentioned that in 95, it was kind of the transition from gambling as a moral issue to problem gambling as, you know, a behavioral issue,
right,
an actual addiction. Do you think that that transition in the language has actually led to a negative impact? Because, well, let me frame negative impact, more people developing a gambling problem.
You know, it's an interesting question. I think we don't have enough debates about these. Remember, our other terms that we used to use for gambling addiction included things like problem gambling, pathological gambling, gambling abuse, compulsive gambling, gambling addict. A lot of non-scientific terms. And then when gambling addiction got recognized in the DSM handbook, in the DSM-3 handbook, and ultimately in the DSM-4 handbook, which was 1994, so again, 1994, it gets into the APA's DSM-4 handbook under pathological gambling, but it's not classified as an addiction. It's classified as a impulse control disorder. And the same chapters are kleptomania, pyromania, trichotillomania, which is currently pulling your hair, intermittent explosive disorder, like acting like Homer Simpson, you know, yelling and screaming for no intents. So it's seen, you know, as an appendix diagnosis, not seen as a mainstream condition.
Yeah.
So what happened in 1995, that was, again, addiction as a brain disease for alcohol, tobacco, cannabis, cocaine, amphetamines, opioids. And at that time, gambling addiction was not called addiction. It was still pathological gambling. It wasn't viewed as an addictive disorder. So from 1995 to 2013, all the research that started to come out, neuroimaging research, genetics, biological, psychological research, epidemiological research, phenomenological research, all started to point that gambling addiction or quote pathological gambling resembled substance use disorder. The craving, the preoccupation, tolerance, withdrawal, inability to stop, all that. So the huge move is moving it from impulse control disorder 1994 into addiction 2013.
Okay.
So 12 years ago when you were what?
14.
14, so you were 8th grade high school.
Yeah.
I don't think we appreciate history enough. Imagine then, all this time people have hummed along, thought that gambling addiction didn't exist, it was pathological gambling, it was impulse control problem, It's fairly rare, not that big of a deal. And all of a sudden, 2013, 2014, it gets popped into the same chapter as alcohol, tobacco, cannabis, and opioids. Mm. So we define it, therefore, as, and change the name to gambling disorder to make it consistent with substance use disorder.
Sure.
We don't say gambling use disorder. That doesn't really make sense. And so you're right. So the labels have changed.
Yeah.
Understanding of what we're looking at has evolved, so we've become a little bit more crystal clear. But yet there's a huge range of gambling behaviors that you can call all sorts of different names. We're not sure what to make out of it.
Yeah.
And you've heard them all, right?
Oh, yeah.
Healthy gambling, recreational gambling, social gambling, at-risk gambling, heavy gambling, excessive gambling, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's tricky, because it's trying to name this wide range of behaviors. And yes, we're interested in all those range, but the one we're most interested in, of course, is this gambling disorder range that creates the most amount of damage to the person, to the family, to society.
Yeah.
And that's where some of the larger questions are, does social gambling, is it a good thing for you? Is it a bad thing? Mm. You know, just this past year, when we've been on the conference circuit, we hear people talk about what lower risk gambling, right? Lower stakes. We also hear questions of why there's so little research being done at the positive aspects of gambling behavior. What are the upper limits? When should people really start gambling? When should they not? And a whole range of questions other than just addiction. And you're correct that the vast majority of gambling studies over the last 25, 30 years has focused on that narrow window, the most severe, quote, severe folks who cause the most damage, gambling disorder. Yeah. So whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, that's been the nature of it. Yeah. But I certainly think it's important to look at the entire scope and range of behavior. And I remember years ago, there were a few studies that were showing older adults that did gamble on a couple times a month basis ended up being happier, lived longer, and had less medical problems. Well, you can imagine what kind of response that sort of study would get.
I can.
Right? And of course, it was funded ultimately by the, quote, gaming industry. So, but to me, it's like, well, there's got to be some positive aspects to this because, you know, millions of people do this all the time and seem to have all sorts of fun. And, you know, it's important to understand all sides of it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think that people watching my channel are probably like, whoa, he's saying something positive about gambling that doesn't usually happen here. And in fairness, it usually doesn't. But I've never actually come out as anti-gambling. I think that there's certain practices that take place that lead more people than should into dangerous behaviors that become addictions. And that's kind of the draw behind the channel.
I think so, yeah.
But the things that you're saying, it's like when a society deems something as like morally reprehensible,
right?
Like gambling was viewed up until, let's call it 95. Maybe that's not a fair point, but like let's say that at that point it switched from being a morality issue to a medical issue, a problem gambling did. That feels like it opens the floodgates for advertising to be okay. Because you don't see advertisements on TV for porn because society views it as morally reprehensible to a certain extent. But you see advertisements for alcohol. You see advertisements for weed sometimes. You see advertisements for gambling. Is the shift from calling it a morality problem to some people have an issue with this, but it's okay generally? Is that what opened the floodgates?
Yes and no. I think, look, the way I view it is all advertising is highly regulated. So the reason we don't see adult entertainment is there's FCC standards that prevent it. Why don't we see advertisements on TV for guns? Same thing. FCC bans that sort of thing. We don't see, you know, commercials for cannabis either, or tobacco products, all essentially regulated at some level of government.
Yeah.
Gambling is not, advertising has not been regulated at really any level of government, from local, state, or federal to say, we don't want these ads here. So in California, where I'm from, obviously, like, the cannabis has very tight ads. For instance, you can't have a print ad within 100 yards of a school, stuff like that. You can't have a paid TV spot of 30 seconds talking about cannabis at all, ever. They will not allow it. So California forbids that. So it's, that's number one. I think gambling advertising has spread because governments have allowed it to. And if you think about how much money is just in the business of gambling advertising, forget about gambling, advertising, the ad agencies, the TV people that are buying time, the online ads, it makes sense why there's a targeted audience here. So on the flip side, though, again, why have we allowed it? The public, that is. You know, if you keep advertising for products that people get disgusted at, the public's ultimately going to walk with their feet and say, we don't like it. The first blitz of gambling advertising that pushed out was that first version, I think, of fantasy sports, right? Where it was just a bombardment. And you were probably like in high school at the time. It was bang, bang, like constant. But the theme of the ads were all the same. It was a bunch of guys partying, winning money, looked like a bar setting, right? You know what I'm talking about? It was the same theme over and over. And people got sick of it. People didn't say this was morally reprehensible. People didn't say this was bad for America. They didn't say this is the manosphere or toxic masculinity. No, they said, this is annoying because you're bombarding and trying to tell us what to do and what to consume. They pivoted and changed dramatically now, and that's why you have six or seven different kinds of strategies that they have advertising. But I don't think it necessarily was a morality issue that allowed it by calling it a gambling disorder. I think, again, you go all the way back to our country. A country was founded as a gamble, as a massive gamble, you know, to come over to America, to start a new life, you know, from all sorts of shores, you know, Pacific, Atlantic, you know, all sorts of people who didn't want to be here, right? American history. And I've seen a number of these presentations. They're so fascinating to me. So I encourage all of your audience and you as well to go back and really think through, what did gambling look like in the original 13 colonies? Where they used lotteries to fund it?
Yeah.
You know, what did Benjamin Franklin say about gambling? He said something like robbery with consent.
Yeah.
Right? And then you have the churches promoting it and forbidding it. Then you had the Wild Wild West, which was essentially a California gold rush. Let's all drop everything, come out for a chance of fortune. That's gambling, right? Then you have all the nation's history. You know, Nelson Rose, the great lawyer, talks about different ways of gambling, wave one, wave two, wave three. Now we're not even in a wave. We're in a set point where it is not going away. Again, I can't emphasize enough, when I was growing up in high school in Chicago, there were no casinos. There was a state lottery that happened to have drawings once a week. There's no scratchers, no internet. There's no gambling. Now in 2025 in Illinois, what do you have? You have mobile sports betting. You have brick-and-mortar casinos inside downtown Chicago. You have a state lottery. And you have all the neighboring states that also have very active casinos. So you've changed the fabric of society and gambling in a state like Illinois, where gambling now has become dominant. But to rewind what your original question is, again, calling something by what it is, gambling disorder, gambling addiction, has all sorts of implications. It either A, makes people more stigmatized, say, oh, I don't want to be like that, or humanizes it to say, you know what, yeah, there is, you know, a chunk of people who are going to develop this, and I just won't be that. And I think that's where it's, that discussion points come out, you know, everywhere you go, whether it's in an ad or whatnot. One last thing I'll say about the ads, again, it's just a strange world we create. We create all these ads, and we pop in responsible gambling messages to the point where you can't understand or hear. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. You know, and those are regulations, those are laws. But to me, that's not nearly as effective as the messaging and the placement of the ads and how it's influencing all sorts of people who see it.
Right. Do you feel like the messaging in and of itself of saying gamble responsibly, is that a good message?
It's an interesting one, right? I mean, It's a funny word, responsible, right? And I go back to, if I were an ad guy, what would I choose instead? You know, do we hear drink responsibly? We do.
We do.
Right?
Do we don't hear, drink and drive.
Don't drink and drive.
It's more direct. It's yeah. more tangible.
Right. Do we hear smoke responsibly or use weed responsibly? Not really. But I don't know what else you would call it, because what you're saying, again, is we want to keep it in the lane of what it's supposed to be. A form of entertainment that costs money, a form of entertainment that is potentially risky. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And so I've seen a couple other things like, you know, watch out, what's the one, make a plan, right? You know, things like that imply there's some risk involved, and if you're going to dally into this world, you better watch out.
Yeah.
Know your limits, stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
When the fun stops was probably one of the first ones that came out in the 80s and 90s, and I think that still holds true. They don't use that as much anymore. I don't know if you've seen that one.
From Nevada.
Yeah. Oh, Nevada used that. Yeah. Are You Winning? I think that's another one I've seen. Yeah. But you put it all together, I think that term, of course, is going to be somewhat problematic because it's going to mean different things for everybody.
Yeah.
And in my world, where I obviously am most concerned, are reducing and minimizing harm from gambling across all levels. So, but by definition, gambling carries significant risk.
Yeah.
So there may be some low-level harm that comes by just using that product, even if you do it in a, quote, responsible manner. Yeah.
It's a bit of an oxymoron if it doesn't have a definition to it. Like, gamble responsibly. Gambling is inherently, as you just said, a risky activity. So doing it responsibly is, like, really an impossibility based on my definition of what responsible is.
Yeah.
But how would you define if someone, you know, if someone had a gun to your head and said, I need you to define this completely correctly right now. How would you define responsible gambling?
Gambling in a way that does not incur long-lasting damage to your body, brain, mind, health, or finances.
That was actually fantastic because we heard the last time we saw each other, we had that definition that they were trying, I believe in Massachusetts, of trying to bet 1% of your net income
right.
on a monthly basis,
right.
which seemed impossible. Given the constraints that a casino might put with table minimums.
Yeah.
But I think that's well said. I think that's not very well explained to the average consumer.
It's not. And again, that's the ticket, right?
Yeah.
Because with alcohol, we try and go with, okay, no more than 7 drinks a week for a man, or for a female, no more than 14 drinks. And that's just a line to what we then say, if you go above it, doesn't make you, quote, a person with alcohol use disorder. It makes you in the zone of heavy or risky drinking. Mm. We can define risky gambling. We can describe excessive gambling better. The implication is if you do those things, there's going to be more damage.
Yeah.
Responsible gambling does sit funny because it sounds like it's saying, okay, you can do this activity we know is inherently dangerous, and here's confines of how you do it in so that you don't get into trouble. Mm. So that's kind of the best term we have right now.
Sure.
I think it's been in play now for at least 25 years. Mm. So to me, it's just simply more about, let's just call what it is. Let's just say, how can we teach and educate people how to gamble without harm?
If you're gambling starting to feel less like fun and more like stress, trust me, you're not alone. Millions of us know what it's like to say, just one more bet, or feel that urge that's really difficult to explain to someone else. That's why I'm so excited to tell you about the sponsor of today's video, Evive. Think of it as having a recovery companion right in your pocket. Someone that knows exactly what you're going through. No lectures, no pressure, just genuine support without judgment. Right when you need it. If you download Evive right now, you'll get guaranteed free access through 2026. Not a trial or some limited version, but the entire platform. Because Evive believes that anyone that's out there that's struggling should get the support that they need. Download Evive today and take the first step towards redefining your relationship to gambling. Evive is only available in select countries. Check the description of this video to download now.
Let's talk about the group that is causing harm in their life. The people that are addicted to gambling, struggling with gambling, dealing with some type of negative in their life as a result of gambling. One number that I told you a little earlier has always thrown me for a loop, mm-hmm. or a set of numbers rather, is the way that we report rates of problem gambling.
Mm-hmm.
So for those in the audience that aren't aware, essentially there's three categories. There's the at-risk gamblers.
Sure.
There is the mild or moderate gambler.
Mm-hmm.
Problem gambler, excuse
okay.
me. And then there's the severe problem gambler, the
right.
pathological gambler.
Sure.
Why is it broken into three categories, and what are the implications of that?
So you're getting into the concept of epidemiology, or basically counting how many humans are either at risk to develop a disease, how many may already have the disease at an earlier stage, and how many already have the full-blown disease. This is just borrowed from medicine. Think like cancer. You know, how many people are at risk, how many have early stages, how many have end stage. So we know that when we do large epidemiological surveys, we can find the most difficult and challenging cases easiest. The most severe folks who've had the most damage, they're easy to count.
Sure.
And that's where the studies have shown in a wide variety, anywhere as low as 0.2% up to 6%. That's a pretty big range, right?
Huge range.
And it makes sense. It's like, you know, we're going to have different communities, different access, different culture, different socioeconomic things. We get it. Then we go back and say, well, what do you know about the other addictions? So tobacco, it's going to be about 11, 12% everywhere you go. But in the southern states, it's as high as 25%. Mm-hmm. Alcohol is about 12, 13% pretty much in every state in America. So there's some similarities, but those are big numbers.
Yeah.
Why gambling disorder at full-fledged has remained relatively flat throughout the last 25 years, I think, is a question of debate. Some will argue and say, no, it's not flat. It's shooting up. Look at Oklahoma and Illinois. They have higher rates of gambling disorder than ever before, and there's all this gambling there. So I think we get uncomfortable because, again, it's pigeonholing people. Either you are lane A, lane B, lane C. But people cross lanes all the time, and we should think that, no, they stay in their lane, right? They don't switch over, but they switch over all the time.
Yeah.
You know, from none to mild to severe, and severe back down to mild. You know, it happens all the time with the condition. What I usually say to folks is, like, listen, since we don't have massive amounts of funding, since we don't have a big workforce to track these things closely, and it's a hard condition to detect, no urine drug screen, no things like that. Right. It's, again, the invisible condition. We have to look at, you know, our best measurements, and our measurements are always going to be self-reports. Mm-hmm. All of these surveys are essentially asking you questions about your gambling behavior and relying on you saying yay or nay. Our other markers of harm, I think, are much more intriguing. Mm-hmm. Bankruptcy rates, divorce rates, admissions to gambling treatment programs, you know, mm-hmm. deaths, suicides that are clearly related to gambling. These are things you can track, and there's a much better outcome measurement, I think.
Yeah.
But that the whole point then about those various lanes, I think, is tricky, because then a lot of times people will use that to set policies or use that to set agendas.
That's my fear. Exactly.
And the problem is, you know, if you see, let's say, problem or gambling disorder rate go from 1% in a community up to 2% 5 years later, epidemiologists will say that's an epidemic. You're doubling the rate of this condition. Mm. Others will say, oh, it's still relatively rare, so why should I invest millions of dollars to keep that number low? Mm. And when sports betting first started to explode in the last 5, 6 years, there were two camps. One camp was like, oh my God, we're going to have all this access. We're going to create a new gambling crisis like we did with opioids.
Mm.
And that 4 to 5% rate is going to shoot up to 10%. Others are like, no, we have done so much more with prevention and treatment support and the internet and, you know, podcasts like yours, that it's going to get to people at an earlier stage so that they don't develop on. So it's, the truth is somewhere down in the middle. You know, I personally subscribe to this philosophy. You know, Malcolm Gladwell talks about it a lot, like the law of the few, right? Where we know that in any given human behavior, it's just a small percentage of people that generate the biggest impact. Positive or negative, right?
I see that.
And I think that's kind of where we're at, where, you know, you can elevate tons of gambling access. And again, that small percentage of people that develop it is very, very concerning, and we need to help them. And as you expand more gambling, that number probably goes up a little bit, but I don't foresee it going up to 40%. Mm. But then again, obesity did at one point. So you go back to the 1950s, obesity rates were like 8%, mm-hmm. tiny. And then in the span of 60 years, they went from that up to 40% of America.
Wow.
So all these things are kind of stuff I think about all the time, thinking about, well, could that happen for gambling?
Yeah.
Could there ever be a day in our lifetime where suddenly the gambling, quote, addiction rate isn't 1% or 2%, but it's 30% or 15%? And that would be a really, really difficult day.
Yeah.
But so far we haven't seen it.
Sure.
Despite all this gambling stuff coming, we've seen rises, but just not up to that massive number.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a couple of just inherent problems with getting data on gambling addiction prevalency, mm-hmm. because it is self-reporting. There's no screener that shows definitive truth. People can just lie
right.
on a gambling screener if they wanted to. So it puts a really difficult position. It would be really interesting to me if we had something like that recommendation scale for alcohol,
mm-hmm.
to know, like, particularly I'm now thinking of the young male emerging adult, the college age population. How many of them are sports betting in a way that would be deemed overconsumption?
Yeah.
And does that mean that they have a gambling addiction? Maybe not. Yeah. But are they gambling as if they do have a gambling disorder?
You know, that's a great one. I think about alcohol in college students, right? We know that binge drinking is part of the, quote, normative experience of college students.
Yeah.
So when you can't use binge drinking as a marker in young adults as a sign of addiction, you can use it, again, as a sign of risky drinking. Mm. And yes, when you binge drink and have heavy drink, even in college, you put yourself at risk for assault, accidents, bad stuff happens, and that's what happens. Mm. But we know that that's the culture. We know that's what the young brain wants to do. And mm-hmm. we know that there's a lot of access. And people have been trying to crack that alcohol code since prohibition. And, you know, in some respects, doing a lot better on certain campuses, others still struggle. Mm-hmm. So you take that in mind and you then pour it over into the gambling world. I don't think it can be something as simple as, oh, if you go above $1,000 a year, you're in green zone, now you're in a yellow zone.
Yeah.
If you do it every single day, daily, you're not in the red zone instead of the green zone. Mm-hmm. So frequency doesn't seem to be a big difference. Amount of money you spend can't, because everyone's story with money is very, very different. What I can emphasize is what I know is a lot of young people, and I'll say to them on the back end, I'm not as interested in how much you spend on gambling or how much time you spend. I'm interested in what's happening in your other parts of your life. Mm-hmm. So to me, the screening question isn't, are you gambling or are you enjoying gambling or how much you're spending? It's, what else are you doing to make yourself into an adult? Hmm. Are you exercising regularly? Are you making new friends all the time? Are you learning new life skills? We just met a couple months ago, right? Hmm. But a year ago in 2024, now compared to recording now in May 2025, if I said to you, have you learned a couple new life skills in the last 12 months? I think you'd say, absolutely.
Yeah, including learning how to record on a camera.
That's right.
Because I keep checking to make sure the red light's on. We're still recording.
Right.
But yes, of course.
So you see, my point is that's where I think in a college age population, I think a radically different approach isn't to focus on the gambling behavior, but on all those other life skills that need to be acquired during mm-hmm. the 18 to 24 age. Mm-hmm. It's not just going to college. It's people who go to trade schools or people who don't go to college and start working, right? Yeah. There can't be measurements like, are you doing okay in school? It's got to be other adulting. So if I had to actually say it, I would think it's a highlight, say we need a better adulting scale, you know, that to apply to that. And then you can imply, oh, well, maybe you're short on adulting stuff in part because the gambling is taking too much impact on your ability to develop.
Yeah, it's stunting your quality of life. It's stunting your growth.
It's slowing your development.
Yeah. And in like an older demographic, I guess that would be expressed as like gambling is consuming your time, your energy.
And the simple question I always ask is your gambling behavior raising your quality of life or is it impacting your quality of life in a negative way? And that, by definition, is a clue that if it's not making your life better, I mean, then there's a question of what's going on there. Mm. I think that's the case. It's jumping to the conclusion, oh, you have a gambling problem. No. Mm. But wait a minute. If you're not sleeping as well, or if you're financially more stressed than you like to be, or if you have less friends and more bored and lonely than you think you ought to be, well, let's dig in a little bit deeper there. But, you know, again, compared to 20 years ago, where we'd focus very much on does this person have or not have a gambling disorder, I think these are the more subtle things. We have to look at each group and say what's important for them. The 18 to 24-year-old person has a lot of different priorities, a lot of different things that they value compared to the 60, 65-year-old crowd. So I think that really needs to be spilled out. But the screening, I think, instead of trying to identify people who are already at risk, is knowing that everyone's at risk. Every human is at risk for cancer, right? Mm. And so instead of trying to look for who are the ones who are most at risk for cancer, we screen everybody universally. Mm. But we have cheap tests to do that, right? We don't have that necessarily for gambling in an objective way. Mm. So instead, I think that's where the education piece comes in, of really highlighting how it could spin out. The 18 to 24-year-old crowd, I think, and I ask you, do you think most of them who do this really truly understand how it could go badly for them? Or do most of them say, yeah, I know there's a thing like gambling addiction, but that won't happen to me?
Yeah, I think anecdotally I would go with the second option there. In my own experience, I figured, you know, I know that theoretically I'm supposed to lose doing this, but I didn't view it as a statistical truth. I viewed it as a probability. Yeah. And that I could still be the exception to the rule. I would say that, you know, I'm 26 now, and someone asked me like a question, I think it was like a month ago, you know, how has gambling changed on college campuses? Mm-hmm. And I don't really know. I think that I've already aged out. I think it's progressing so quickly that like right now, the generation of like, not the generation necessarily, the age group of 16 to 22, mm-hmm. I genuinely believe that they view sports betting as investing, as a by and large. Yeah. Not everyone, but yeah. Enough of them that it's becoming a real issue, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's really interesting. At UCLA, I am around a lot of young people, and I went to a fraternity a couple months ago, and I said, how many of you guys are using an app to bet on sports? 80%.
Yeah.
And we had a nice talk about that. And you're right. You know, and I started to explore with them, well, how come? Some said, well, it's just fun. Mm. I don't mind spending money on it. And they use the word spending, not losing, spending. Another form of entertainment, like going into movies. Mm. Others said, no, I think this is a reliable way of making money. And I said, oh, you mean like a job? They're like, not quite, but it's better than a job. I don't have to work. I can get a little extra walking around money. And with those, you know, again, I said, wait a minute, why don't you just get a real job? And then you could have walking around money. And every of them said, why should I? So there wasn't an imply that I should work. It's like, why should I work when I can make it here on my phone? Yeah. Then another batch who just had no clue. They were like, I don't know. I just do it because everyone else is doing. And then there was others who were like really into it because it was doing something for them internally, psychologically. And obviously, we'd be worried about them. They're doing it to take away feelings of stress and whatnot.
The obvious signs, right.
But I think that's where... You're right. And then you flip it. And I then said to them, how many of you have been to a brick and mortar casino? Zero.
Because they're not old enough, probably.
Well, in California, you can actually go to 18 and up.
Okay.
Yeah, you can go to some tribal casino. But they're like, we don't have a car, it's really far away, and it's really expensive.
Yeah.
So that's definitely changed. And so how they're gambling is exclusively on the phone.
Yeah.
Exclusively digital. And then this idea of, you know, and anything now, any March Madness pool, any fantasy thing, it's all done on the phone. It's all done, you know, electronically. So the idea, again, of going into a brick-and-mortar casino is just not there. Uh-huh. I spend a lot of time in Vegas, and anytime I'm in Vegas, I like to walk the floors of the casinos and talk to people. And, you know, it's shocking how the sports books have changed dramatically just in the last 5 years. You know, it's kiosks, you know, rarely you see people there. I mean... 20 years ago, 15 years ago, you would see a sports book, really on any day of the week, have a good chunk of humans in the sports book, watching the games, looking at the lines, because that was the only place you could do it. Now you see, again, everything's automated. There's no reason for any human to go into a sports book. So even during times of big games, I notice, there's a lot of chairs that are open. So, and it's mainly like my generation who's used to that social atmosphere.
Sure.
So a lot of the 18 to 24-year-olds, I say, well, where do you watch the sports? They watch it on their phone, right?
Yeah.
So I just got YouTube TV last year because of the NFL Red Zone, NFL package. And again, it's the same thing. You get really high-quality streaming. You're watching the sports. You don't need to be in a bar. You're just on wherever. Yeah. So that, I think, is how it's changed so much. It's just taking the casino out of everything, put it in our pockets, and then people just do it ad hoc, whenever. So it's just like an embedded thing.
I want to be careful what I'm implying by saying this, because I don't want to say like, yes, going to the casino and sitting at the sports book with a group is a healthy and good thing to be doing.
Right.
But isn't isolating during your gambling one of the risk factors for developing a problem with gambling?
I think, you know, isolation, doing anything solo is a concern, right? Drinking, tobacco, cannabis. The whole point of gambling, it's supposed to be entertainment. Yeah. Now, it's your choice. Maybe you like being entertainment, doing your entertainment by yourself, going to a movie by yourself. Maybe you're like, no, I love doing things together with my friends, or we like to bet on sports together. So You're absolutely right. And that's what the difference, the power of the phone, the power of all this mobile sports betting. It's much easier to drive this entertainment activity into solitude.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where it's tricky for some. Some people love it. Some people don't want to do it with others. Mm. And that's their choice. But on the whole, we as humans crave positive social connections. Mm. We love it when we're together. We love it. But the phone has made it so much easier not to be together than to actually be together. So I'll give you a quick example. So in college, the Bulls were starting to become amazing.
Sure.
And the very first year they won the championship, 1992, we watched the Bulls beat the Lakers in 5 games. Again, this was 35 years ago, and I remember that like it was yesterday. So in the dorm, we'd set up the chairs, we got the TV out. It was a community event. Sure. Not a single bet was placed. Hmm. 20, 30 people, you know, 4 hours of entertainment. That was the bonding. Hmm. Nowadays, you know, that still happens from time to time, but it's all going to be around the gambling on the game, not the community of we're watching our team play.
100%.
100%. And that's why I think for the young people, that concept, hey, do you want to come over and watch the games with me and my buddies? I think it still happens, but it's a different experience. They come over, watch the game, they're all got their phone, they're all betting on their own thing. Maybe they share, hey, what do you got? What do you got?
Picks.
Struggling with an addiction can make you feel like you're all alone. But trust me, it doesn't have to be that way. At Right Choice Recovery, a family-owned and operated treatment center in New Jersey, we are here for you, and we're dedicated to helping you break free from addiction and change your life for the better. Whether you're struggling with substances or a gambling addiction, this is the spot for you. With personalized care, real support, and a team that understands exactly what you're going through, we're here to walk with you on your journey to recovery, because recovery is possible. And it all starts with the right choice. Check the description of this video today for more information.
You know, I think that's maybe why, this is a theory now, maybe why gambling streams are so popular. Why do people watch other people gamble? It's to talk to people in the chat, to feel like someone else is doing the same thing that they're doing.
Yeah.
If we're driving people closer to isolation with the way that gambling is now being pushed out, there has to be that outlet for the social connection and to get that kind of confirmation that what I'm doing is not awful, what I'm doing is okay.
Yeah.
I think that's what's driving so many young men.
I mean, that's one area I haven't looked deeply in. How many gambling streams are out there?
Thousands.
Thousands.
Yeah.
And some of them are guys playing slots, right? Mm-hmm. Some of them are guys playing video games and betting on them, right?
Guys and girls. Stuff. It's everyone.
There are a lot of sports betting streams where you're showing, like, their same game parlays or what?
It would be like guys going and talking about like what picks they have, showing. Like if you look at like a Barstool stream, it's much different than if you look at like a slot stream on Kick. So a Barstool stream would be like four guys, their bets would be at the bottom, they're reacting to the game. Whereas the Kick stream would be like a guy doing $10,000 spins on a slot machine.
Yeah.
So they're both gambling streams. They're kind of attracting a different crowd.
Yeah, like the gambling syndicate, all the guys, and then they're watching the game. But you're not watching the game with them. You're watching their reaction to the game.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So it creates this like the social loop that I think is missing from the modern gambling experience that inherently has to be there. It's not going to shock me if like FanDuel TV becomes something where you can live stream in and share your picks and if everyone pops
that
up.
Combination of reality TV.
Yeah.
Voyeurism, watching people win or lose, wanting to be included in like a community, right?
Yeah.
And I remember there was a stream of guys, grass just growing. You heard this one?
No.
And I remember it was a few years ago, and it was just a camera of his lawn.
Okay.
And then, but it was a very well manicured lawn, and the whole stream was just like, when's he going to come out? Is he going to trim it today? How much did it grow today? You know, it was all like this. So we all ultimately seek escape. We all ultimately seek things we're curious about that sometimes we don't even know why we're curious about. But I think a lot of these streams combine, and you're hitting it, all these strange elements into one event.
Yeah.
The gaming, the gambling, the community, the voyeurism, the exhibitionism, the I just can't look away, the kind of car crash phenomena.
Yeah.
The always what's coming up next.
Yeah. It's a car crash, but they're selling a car. At the end
of the exactly.
You know, buy your own car.
Did you ever listen to Howard Stern?
I know who he is. I never really listened to
him. That's amazing to me. And your audience is like, really? So Stern is obviously an American popular culture icon and really popularized, you know, the shock jocks, you know, from the 80s and the 90s, almost 30 years in the business. And in his heyday, you know, obviously his reach and footprint on America was profound. He moved over to Sirius XM, you know, he had the whole thing. But his show is 4 hours. It's a long stretch of time.
Yeah.
And he mastered the art of, you couldn't turn it off because you always wanted to know what he was going to say next. There was just pure entertainment. And it was the ability to draw you in through a wide variety of techniques. And I think the streamers do the same thing. It's visual. It's auditory. There's elements of something's coming. If I wait, I might get that code or I might get...
A giveaway, even.
Giveaways. Yeah. Or it's just... And their production values are, you know, they're not
fantastic. No, some of them are fantastic.
With some different screens and, yeah.
And I think that even can be, like, this is a little bit of a tangent, I guess, but, like, production value attracts a different audience based on how crisp it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, blur your stream with a guy who's maybe yelling into, like, a very raspy microphone will attract a much different audience than Drake would attract streaming on, like, a $20,000 camera.
Right.
But that's intentional.
Yeah.
And everyone has their own niche, but at the end of the day, you are influenced by what you watch over and over again.
Sure.
And it's conditioning people to believe that what's going on screen, it might be some crazy stuff.
Yeah.
But they're like, why couldn't I do 5% of that?
Right.
You know, if they're betting $10,000, why can't I bet $500?
Yeah, right, right. So it's an interesting message because what you're getting at, I think, is so fascinating with the internet is that stuff that you're seeing there, you're like, wait a minute, I could apply that into my own life.
Yeah.
Whereas... when I was a kid, I'm watching Spider-Man, Incredible Hulk, $6 Million Man. I'm watching Cosby Show. These are things that are in the TV and will never reach me in real life. There's this, you know what I'm saying? There's a separation there that, okay, entertainment is over there and it won't come into my life today.
Yeah.
And I don't think we talk about that enough because that's how it was in the 80s. And the 90s and the MTV generation, and then reality TV started to come, right? And then you only know a world of reality TV. So I know of a world where it was mainly scripted shows for many, many, many years, and reality TV was something different, and it's taken over. It's still a huge chunk of entertainment value, but nothing like YouTube and the idea that you can connect with the very person you're watching.
Yeah.
You can have your life impacted by the person you're watching. Mr. Beast is a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
You know, where the giveaways, the contests, and if you're watching him, you're like, that could be me.
Yeah.
Whereas I could never be on General Hospital or, you know, a sitcom of any kind.
If they let Stephen A. on, I mean, they might let you on because he sticks.
That's right.
My mom watches General Hospital. Yeah. But no, I get exactly what you mean. And like the ability for someone to even comment on this video, that's something that didn't exist it existed, but it wasn't as popular 10, 20 years ago. So it's blurring the lines between, you know, what you can do versus what you're seeing happening. And I think emulation has become way bigger. The last piece that I really wanted to touch on today was game design. Game design, frequency, and just the differences in play between gambling a few years ago and gambling now. I spoke with Philip Newall from Bristol University, and his assertion in the video that we did together was basically sports betting is experiencing a transition in its design to become more similar to a slot machine,
right?
More similar to a casino game. Have you seen that play out? Do you agree with that? And what are the implications of it?
Oh, 1,000%. I mean, it's not sports betting. It's a slot machine. It's a slot machine in speed, in frequency, in randomness, and everything. So you take it all the way back, right? You know, traditional sports betting, you know, 1940s and onwards, we're talking about longer bets, you know, win, loss, money line, maybe a parlay, maybe a teaser, but things that would take several hours to reach a conclusion. So there's a speed issue there. And even when you started having internet gambling, it was always still a speed issue. You could only bet on one game or multiple games at once, and you still need a couple hours for it to resolve. Then, 10 years ago is when we first started to hear about in-game betting. Mm-hmm. And that seemed impossible because how could you do it? Who would set the lines? How is this actually occurring? So it's all computer-based now. Mm-hmm. Fast forward now to where we are right now with the combination of artificial intelligence, incredible access to long-term data so that you can put out essentially infinite number of a variety of different bets. So I've been using more and more this idea of what I call kind of highly processed gambling. So it's like highly processed foods. We don't know when these bets are given to us, how they're made, who makes them, what went into them. But we know there's a lot of them, and there's incredibly cheap to make, and they're all designed to satisfy something in us. What is it, 50, 60% of the bets on mobile sports betting are same game parlays? I've heard that through the rumor mill from a number of industry executives. Not just a couple, but several different. Really? 60%? 70%? They're like, yeah. Why? There's so many of them. They're infinite. Low stakes, big jackpot. That's a lottery. That's a slot machine. Low stakes, big wins. Yeah. Multiple things that happened across. High profit margins. Really high profit margins off a same game parlay compared to just a straight bet.
Yeah.
And if you even look at just the computer design of most of these mobile gaming apps, and again, what are they, 40, 50 different operators throughout America? How many different computer designers have? I mean, highly, highly gamified. And now more and more automatic, right? So notifications. And because AI knows what kind of bets I like. Hey, Tim, here's a pre-made parlay. Here's, would you like to get in on this one? So it's presenting me a piece of salami or a piece of bologna, knowing I like that stuff. It's highly processed. So I think it might have been that same professor, I don't know who it was, who said, you know what we need to do? We need to have two things. We need to have, for consumers, when they're placing bets online, to know which ones were generated by AI and which ones are human-made bets. So imagine that. No, this bet is certified and made by an actual bookmaker.
Wow.
Versus this one's generated by a computer.
Yeah.
And that might influence some people's behavior. Because I, for certain, do not believe people would be willing to place a lot of bets on wagers that are not generated in a way they don't really know how it's made.
Sure. If they're made aware that it's like almost a disingenuous process, they'd be more willing to, you know, say what's going on with
this. Yeah, why would I put my money into this? Yeah. I mean, it's weird because the lottery, people have this weird faith in the lottery because you can see the balls.
Yeah. Something, there's something to it.
Right? Versus if you just said, oh, here are the numbers.
Yeah.
You're like, I don't trust that at all.
No.
So that's an element. Number two thing is someone, I wish I could give credit to the researcher, the idea of let's identify each bet as like a green diamond, blue diamond, or black diamond bet. Have you heard of this?
I've not.
Stratifying by risk, saying this is a black diamond wager you're going to take. This is a risky wager that is not likely to win. Kind of like what we do in investments, like this is a grade A bond or this is a grade C.
Sure.
So allowing people to recognize, okay, if I'm going to place $20 on this type of wager, oh, there's a really, really good chance I'm not going to win. Or there's a really good chance that, you know, this is pretty, you know, this is a fair, straight thing. Not a mathematical odds thing, but just that, hey, you're going to bet on this. The risky level is that it's a lot of risk and the likelihood of a reward is much smaller.
You know, that system sounds like it's probably pulled from like ski slopes, right?
That's exactly what it is.
Now, does that end up having the inverse effect of saying like, you know, I am so good at gambling.
I'm going to go double black.
Because if I don't, then I'm like, I'm bitching out. Like,
that's right.
Like that.
That's right.
Well, do you think that could happen to a younger demographic?
I don't know. Maybe? I mean, we don't do that in any other addictive-like behavior. I think for some folks, it gets really confusing to say, well, what am I looking at here? But we know what happens on the ski slopes is that if you fall down and break your leg on a double black and you weren't ready, that's on you. That's not on the mountain.
Yeah.
So these are all ideas of just figuring out a way to get people to take more ownership of what they're doing with their time and their money. And I think that's what you're getting at is these apps are so easy.
Yeah.
There's no owner's manual.
No.
There's no cost of entry to get in. There's no anyone showing you how to do these things. And there's no monitoring. So in a bar, there's always going to be a monitor of someone saying you've had too much.
Yeah.
In a brick and mortar casino, there's always going to be somebody who steps in if they notice that you're distressed. You're not going to have that in mobile sports. We know that. And instead, I think this idea of like, well, someone said to me a couple years ago, shouldn't we make a gambling license so that like a driver's license. Like, if you wanted to actually get an account on one of these apps, you'd have to pass a basic test of knowledge, and then you'd granted a driver's license. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I thought, you know what, that's, I don't know if that's going to work, and that's never going to happen in America.
Yeah.
But the whole idea that you can't just jump into gambling without understanding risks, what it is, and what you get. Just like, do people just jump into using cannabis without being taught how to use it?
Yeah.
They try it out, maybe a brother or sister or an older adult shows them how to do it.
Sure.
But, you know, you think about those giant, like, water rigs or those giant, you know, glass rigs. You know, if you never use it, you don't know how to use it.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has to show you. And I'm wondering, in that mobile sports betting space, who can show young people or old people how to use these apps in ways that's thoughtful and helpful?
Anything you want to leave the audience with?
Oh, no, this is great, Rob. I think what you're doing is terrific. You're going to reach a really big audience and a lot of folks that I won't reach through our lectures. If anyone wants to know more about the work we do, they can look at our website, uclagamblingprogram.org. You can reach out to me through email, through that website, and I'd love to be on again and talk about more stuff.
Absolutely. To anyone looking for those links, once again, they're in the description of this video. And if you're looking for another video that's maybe about someone in recovery from a gambling addiction, I want you to check this one out next. Let's keep getting better together, one day at a time.